Green calm below, blue quietness above. John Greenleaf Whittier. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll enjoy and peruse our backlog of episodes. And to all the returning listeners, thank you all so much, as always. Please be sure to like, download, subscribe, rate 5 stars, whatever your platform of choice asks you to do to show your creator support. I would appreciate if you would do that as well. This week, we will be moving into Europe from Asia and discussing the numerous material cultures emerging in and around the Ural Mountains and the European steppe between the Black and Caspian Seas. Between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever of those you prefer. Though there is probably a little overlap between the peoples we will be talking about and the peoples we discussed, I think it was back in January or February, when we talked about Central Asia and the Celtiminar culture. Not to mention, potential interactions with peoples moving out of Siberia that we discussed last week. In fact, most of the peoples living in this region, regardless of the material culture at the start of this season's time frame, have some ancestry from the ancient North Eurasians that were on Siberia's western fringes, and a little bit of the Western hunter-gatherers of Europe. And this population as a whole, or I should say these populations as a whole, are referred to as Eastern hunter-gatherers. And one of the big changes that are going to take place this season, and that we will cover, is going to be another big population change or merge in the area during the 4th millennium BC. Another thing to keep in mind is that, like the Middle East and the river valleys of China, there's going to be areas of overlap between various groups and periods where different groups ebb and others flow and flood, and then they ebb and new groups emerge and the process repeats. Also, some groups are considered or debated to be extensions of or regional variations of other cultures that we will be discussing. And I'll do my best to point those out when I can, though I'm sure I'm going to make mistakes. And as you might guess, this is going to be, there's going to be several episodes covering this area because there's a lot going on over, it's very well documented. There's a lot more sources to go off of, not just in English, but in a number of other languages. So that's all stuff to look forward to. Now, to start, we will focus on what is known as the Bug Dniester culture. The name comes from the Bug and Dniester rivers, along which and between the people of the material culture lived. Bug, or Buga, is Slavic, meaning something like river filled with bushes or trees, or river overgrown with bushes and trees. And it's possibly from the Indo-European Bug, which meant bent. This river today flows through Poland and forms its border with Belarus, while it flows south to Ukraine. There are two theories on the etymology of the Dniester. One says it comes from the Sarmatian Danunazia, meaning the close river. And another less widely accepted breakdown is that it came from a combination of the Scythian Danu, which also means river, and Thracian Ister, or the Danu Ister, or literally the river Ister. Though this one is not widely accepted. The Greeks called it the Tiras, which is from the Scythian Tura, meaning rapid. Today, this flows through the south of Ukraine and Moldova into the Black Sea. Now, they are considered a Neolithic culture. At least the Soviets categorized them as Neolithic, and everyone else pretty much groups them in as well. But this is important to note that this is not an agricultural group. They are still primarily hunter-gatherers, and fishing thrown in as well. They're categorized as the Neolithic because they are starting to use microliths and because they have adopted pottery from some groups to the west, that we'll discuss in future episodes as we move further into Europe.
Though, as we'll talk about, they do seem to adopt some agriculture towards the end of the Bug-Niester phase of material culture in the region. And this lasts between 6,300, so they've been around for a little while by the start of this season's episode, and it will go until about 5,000 BC. Their diets, again, at least at the start of this season, are mostly made up of wild sources of grasses, grains, things like that. But they're also hunting a large amount of animals. Their diets seem to have had more meat than what you would expect in other places. There's still lots of wild herds of aurochs, red deer, roe deer, boar, and again, they're also fishing. They're fishing things like roaches, pikes. They also have access to eels. They get these from the rivers, and in some cases, probably from the Black Sea as well. One of the big events that may have kind of led to the end of the Bug-Niester culture is the flooding of the Black Sea from the Mediterranean, which the date on this is debated. Some people think it's 6,000, but some of the more recent sources has the Mediterranean kind of overflowing the Bosphorus into the Black Sea, making it salt water at that point. The latest that this would have happened would have been right around 5,000 BC. And this is, some people think that this corresponds to a lot of flood myths in the area, though there are even, wider fringe theories that this is part of, like, the universal flood that shows up in a lot of different mythologies. But this flood would have happened before, some of the events that, led to, like, the flood myths in Mesopotamia, which are probably, again, we've already talked about this before, but are probably, like, a number of events happening at various points throughout, Mesopotamian history, that all kind of got conglomerated into one single event. But this, this is all kind of debated. Some of it's pseudoscience, some of it is actual science, and there's sometimes an attempt to kind of conglomerate the two together or combine the two together. But regardless, it is, again, very possible that there are sites that are underwater now because the Black Sea did expand as it became a saltwater body. Now, the Bug-Niester, as I said, they do use pottery. They do have it by the start of this season, possibly as early as 6,100. And it appears like they adopted it, again, from cultures to their west. And they're on the western end of the Pontic-Caspian Steppe, so they do have they are kind of at the forefront of mixing with groups from Europe, as well as people coming out of Anatolia are also coming up from the west as well. They're not sailing directly up the sea just yet. So they're kind of coming up from the land route from Anatolia through what is now Bulgaria, Greece, those regions. And their pottery is very similar to what you'll see in those neighboring cultures. Again, we'll talk about those later, but I'll go ahead and drop the name for the Koros culture. That's where it appears they're getting their pottery from. It's flat-bottomed, and it is designed for being placed in fire and cooking in fire. And it's extremely similar in terms of how it looks and how it is made. They may have been trading for it, or they were trading for it initially, but then it seems like they did learn how to make it on their own. And they will begin to decorate it with very, kind of very thick, wavy lines. They do not have permanent settlements. They are very much mobile, hunter-gatherer fishers. We they have a number of sites that have been found. It doesn't appear like many of them are used for very long periods of time at any one point. But they do come back to places. You know, they'll use up the resources. They'll go somewhere else, and then they may return. You know, every few years or so. And this is something you'll see at a number of places. Most of the peoples along the Pontic-Caspian Steppe are, you know, mobile. There's a few permanent settlements we'll get to later, but none at this point. Now, kind of in the early portion of about the 5th millennium, so sometime between 5,900 to about 5,500, they are beginning to adopt domesticated animals. These are ones they've probably picked up from peoples coming up from Anatolia. They pick up cattle, and they adopt a more cattle-based economy, it appears. But they're still relying heavily on, foraged grasses, grains, and things like that. And they don't give up hunting completely. They still, hunt, gather, and fish as well, but they're supplementing that with animals they control. Now, towards the end of their run, about 5,300 to about 5,000, you do begin to see the use of agriculture being adopted. They're importing, or not importing necessarily, but they are beginning to plant einkorn, emmer, spelt as well as barley. This isn't, super widespread, but it is something that they're beginning to kind of take a hold of. I mentioned, the rise of the water level of the Black Sea. This has other impacts on the environment. The forests begin to retreat. The environment becomes warmer, and the grassland from the Pontic-Caspian Steppe begins to expand and take over this forested area. So that kind of does away with their large-scale hunting of things like deer and boar. And that is probably what leads to them abandoning the Bogdnester material culture. At that point, they begin to shift and develop into a new material culture, which we'll get into later. Now that leads to another contemporary culture with the Bogdnester, and that is the Yanislawica culture of what is now central Poland. These people appear to have had been related in some way to the Bogdnester, as well as other peoples in the Pontic-Caspian Steppe region and in the rest of Eastern Europe. They kind of had a few different groupings along various rivers in what is now Poland, the Vistula, the Niemen Basin, and the Bierzba, I think that's how that's pronounced, basin. And they used very similar types of tools, flint, a very similar type of tools to the Bogdnester culture. They used flint, animal bone. In fact, they may have been mining flint in a few of the areas they occupied. And we have found some of their burials. They found three of their burials, all men, and they were all accompanied by, a decent amount of grave goods. They had some microlithic blades, though it looks like most of the tools they were making were more kind of Mesolithic in terms of size. They did have some, microliths. They had animal teeth necklaces, bone and antler tools, in addition to their flint tools, as well as all of the remains were coated with red ochre, or at least red ochre was used in a decent amount in their burial ceremonies. But these are kind of to the north, so they are also hunting and gathering, and they don't have to worry about the retreat of the forest nearly as much. And they kind of appear to keep up with their hunter-gatherer traditions. And they disappear right around the same time. They disappear a little bit later than the Bognester. They disappear. The dates are a little wonky. Some people have them disappearing right around 4000 BC, but then there is some evidence that at least a small number of people carried on in this kind of traditional, or at least at that point, traditional lifestyle. In some cases, possibly as late as the 3rd millennium BC. Though again, some of this is debated. Some people think it just might be, you know, a few small holdouts of hunter-gatherers. All right, and apologies if the audio has just changed. I had to turn on my fan. It's very hot where I am this weekend, and my AC is not doing a great job of keeping things cool. So I turned on my fan. Apologies if it messes with the audio a little. And before I forget, also, the name of the culture comes from the type site, which is near... which is like a little village in Poland. It was first discovered in 1964. Now, the next culture we're going to talk about is the Dnieper Donets culture. And it is to the immediate west of where the Bognester was. It's also a little bit to the west of where the Yanislawica culture was as well. And the name comes from the Dnieper and Donets rivers. The name of the Dnieper is also, you've got two options, very similar to the two options you had for the Dniester. And the first is the more widely accepted, and that means, or that is that it came from the Sarmatian Danu Apara, which means the farther river. Where, again, if you have the Dniester, which is the Danu Nadzia, which is the close river, and then you have the Danu Apara, which is the farther river. That is the more widely accepted etymology. But then you also have the option that it is from the Scythian Danu Apar, which is like the deep river, which is a reference to the fact that the Dnieper doesn't have a lot of good places to cross at. It doesn't have a lot of fords. At least historically it didn't. I'm sure these days there are a lot more constructions and things like that that have allowed for easier crossing. In classical Greece, I believe it was referred to as the Borysthenes River. That's what Herodotus calls it, at least. And there are a couple of things that, you know, this could potentially mean. We're not 100% sure. But he got it from the Scythians, which either meant something like Barustana, meaning like the yellow place, or Barustana, meaning place of beavers, which, there is other evidence, linking like long range beaver skin trade with places in what is now, Iran. And there was like an old Iranian water goddess who supposedly wore beaver skins. So, we'll talk more about Scythian and Iranian religion overlap much, much later. But just keep that in mind as well. Now, the other river giving the culture its name is the Donets, or it's just like the Little Don River. The Donets flows into the Don River. But its name is believed to come from either some Iranic language or the Sarmatian Danu, meaning the river. The Sarmatians, they may not have had like a separate name. They could have considered that the main branch of the Don, potentially. The Greeks wrote that down as Tanais, or at least that's what they called the Don River. So they would refer to the Donets as like the small or little Tanais. Now, the Dnieper Donets, as I said, they are to the, I may have misspoke, but they are to the east of the Bognester culture, and they are also a little bit more to the north. So they're kind of on the border of the steppe and the forest So they kind of overlap in those two areas. And the oldest site, I believe, that they've discovered evidence of the Dnieper Donets is at the Derivka, which is also a site for another material culture that we'll talk about shortly. So, again, this is one of those areas where there's a little bit of overlap between peoples. But it looks like the Dnieper Donets, arose maybe sometime as early as 5,800, possibly 5,600. And initially they're, you know, just along, you know, the coast of, not the coast, but the banks of the Dnieper River. Specifically, Derivka is on one of the tributaries of the Dnieper. It's called the Omlinik River. But after that initial phase of, you know, 200-300 years, and as the environment is beginning to change, but, you know, it's getting warmer, the forests are retreating, they're still, you know, they're still on that boundary area where the forest does not kind of fall back from. And they're probably in a decent position, like, ecologically speaking. They're primarily hunter and gatherers. They have forests still, whereas, say, the Bugnester, they're beginning to lose their forests and access to their hunted and gathered animals and things. So they're not undergoing quite as rapid of a climatic change. In fact, the climatic changes they're seeing are probably helping them because, you know, you have more animals, you know, trying to stay in the forests. And they have a little bit wider of a range of animal bones that have been found. You still have aurochs, red deer, roe deer, but you also have things like elk. They also have like wildcats, rabbits, bears, onagers, wild horses, foxes, wild boar, which is something the Bugnester has, but the wild boar are more likely to stay around. So they're able to kind of probably deal with that. And it's probably, you know, you've got more of these animals coming in trying to stay in their environment. It's probably leading to a surplus of food, or at least much easier hunting than what they're used to. So that probably allows them to grow their population at a much higher rate than, say, the Bugnester, which might be seeing a decline in population. So that leads the Dnieper Donets culture to spread quickly, but from the, you know, from the banks of the Dnieper up to the banks of the Don. And in addition to that, they are also, by way of not just the Bugnester people to their west, they are also gaining contact with groups from the east who are also handling domesticated animals now. So they are having access to people that have access to cattle, but who also are bringing up things like sheep and goats from the Caucasus Mountains. Then you also have things like domesticated pigs. Dogs become more common at the Dnieper Donets sites. And then eventually you get things like horses. Now, it's not 100% clear if these are domesticated horses or if they're wild horses that are just being hunted, and they're maybe starting to try to domesticate them. I've got an episode planned on horse domestication. It'll be not too long from now, but we'll talk about that. But it's possible that they are starting to domesticate horses in addition. So they're in a very, you know, choice position to not only survive, but to thrive. And that leads them to spread to a wider area and interact with more people. The Dnieper Donets culture expands very rapidly after about 5,200. And within just, 500 years or so, they are already, well, they're as far east as the Volga River and the Ural Mountains. And there's a large number of Dnieper Donets sites.
very few permanent sites. They are, you know, mobile hunter-gatherer pastoralists, but there are a few places where it does appear that they began to settle down. We found some small subterranean huts, you know, dug down into the earth. They have their floor underneath ground level, and their homes are generally covered with bark and, you know, things like that. Their tools are, again, fairly Neolithic, though they do hold on to some Mesolithic larger blades like that. Their pottery initially is very rough, and it all has pointed base, which people think that means they got it from places, you know, near in Western Europe, where that was more common, things like what is now Northern Germany, possibly Scandinavia. But as, you know, they begin to move south and east, they begin to adopt the flat-bottomed pottery that perhaps they learned about from people who were abandoning the old Bug Nester sites, or perhaps it's something they developed themselves, you know, once they learned, you know, it's easier to just place it in fire and cook that way. And it appears that their pottery is unique compared to some of their contemporary neighbors. It doesn't look like it's made in the same way or decorated in the same way as their neighbors do. But as time goes on, pottery become much, much more important to them. And again, they use flint for their tools, bone, antler, that kind of thing. Something they had in abundance where they lived. We've found a large number of burials that are tied in with the Dnieper Donets cultures. We found more of their burials than I think we have sites. And some of these are very large, with I think the largest one's like 900 individuals that have been buried. And they're mostly uniform. There are a couple of instances where, you know, some things are out of the ordinary compared to some of the others. In some cases, it appears that the individuals may have been exposed for a period of time and then buried. There's also certain instances where only individuals' heads were buried, but by and large, they were interred, you know, whole-bodied. They all had grave goods. You know, you have things like tools, but you also have ornaments, shell necklaces, beads. There are even some cases of copper beads, though it doesn't appear they're not using copper as like a tool yet. They have types of crystal. They have objects made of boar tusks. They have weapons. You know, some are probably hunting implements, but there are some, specifically maces, which are thought to have been like a sign of some type of authority over, you know, people that they were living with. We'll talk about this more later, and I think I've already touched on it when we talked about some of the Egyptian stuff, but mace heads are, you know, a mace is something you're only using to kill. It really doesn't have any other purpose than, say, like a axe, which you could use to conceivably chop stuff and not hunt or defend yourself. Maces are strictly, you know, you're trying to kill something, or most likely the case, someone. You're not going to use a mace to hunt a wild boar, for instance. For that, you're going to use something like a spear or, you know, a lot of arrows shot by several individuals. There are also children that have been found with maces. So that leads some people to conclude that, well, a child's not really going to use a mace, so this may have been something he had inherited from someone else. So there is possibility of, you know, some type, not necessarily of leadership, but of some type of prestige or something along those lines from, you know, a parent or an ancestor or something like that. So make of that what you will. Also, some of the items they're buried with are things probably coming up from the Caucasus, which, you know, this along with the deer and the goats and sheep, again, is another evidence of interactions with groups either in the Caucasus or who have traveled up from the Caucasus, which you begin to see more and more the later you get in the Dnieper Donets cultures timeline. We have also found figures, like human figures that they were creating. No female representations have been found, or at least they don't, you know, they don't have anything that distinguishes them as female. They don't have breasts or anything like that. These appear all to be male figures. Also, their skeletons, at least from the attack ones we found, show that they're larger on average than, you know, other contemporary Neolithic peoples, say in the Middle East or China or Egypt. They average about 5.5 feet, which, you know, agricultural populations are only about 5 feet, give or take a couple of inches. And that's probably because, again, they have a wider variety of diet. They're still getting a lot more protein regularly. You know, probably a little bit healthier. They are not agricultural, at least for most of their history, until right around 4,300, 4,200, somewhere in that period. Some of their sites do appear to have adopted some level of agriculture, probably not too intensive, but they found millet, wheat, and peas, which they're probably getting via either Central Asia or the Caucasus, which again is another evidence of large-scale trade and or migrations from those regions. Now, as we've already discussed, they spread out very quickly. This is in part due to the fact that, again, agriculture not widespread among the Dnieper Donets sites. You know, hunter-gathering plus pastoralism, they aren't necessarily tied to the land in the same way other peoples have been. Now, while some, you know, do settle and become agricultural, others continue, you know, this mobile pastoralist lifestyle. And as they get spread further and further apart, and, you know, new peoples maybe move into areas that they were occupied, or they begin to interact with people who had been living in the new areas they've moved into, you begin to see breakdowns, or at least evolutions, of the deep Dnieper Donets culture in various regions. And they begin to lose ties with, their neighboring cousins. And they begin to form new links and things like that with the peoples they're meeting, or they begin to develop in different ways in, you know, maybe their old heartland. And that's kind of where we're going to pick up, I guess, next episode. I wasn't expecting this to take quite as long as it has already, but we're going to return to, the initial Dnieper Donets site next week, where we'll be talking about the Sredni Stog culture. And this is an area where the initial Sredni Stog culture emerges in what was the Dnieper Donets heartland. In fact, the Sredni Stog site of, which I've already mentioned, Derivka, this is an area where you do see both Dnieper Donets style burials and what kind of becomes the standard for Sredni Stog burials. So you can see where the Sredni Stog do begin to develop their own, or a different way of life than, say, the Dnieper Donets. They begin to innovate and become something else. And this is something that's happening all throughout the Dnieper Donets regions. You know, you have different groups, again, where they're maybe meeting new peoples, merging with them, they're losing their old ties, their old cultural connections and continuity. But that is something, again, we'll continue next week. But there's a lot of these small regional cultures that emerge. And as we've seen, at least with the Dnieper Donets, they are
beginning to interact more with groups coming up from the Caucasus and other groups coming in from Siberia, though that's to a much lesser extent than the Caucasian hunter-gatherers. And we'll get into that next week with the Srednyi Stog and other groups that begin to phase out or replace the Dnieper Donets cultures. So I hope you look forward to that. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, or you can comment on the YouTube video, and I will try to respond there. Still no word back from Spotify, so I'm trying to find something to replace that theme music, but I haven't kind of found anything that I can firmly, you know, claim, yeah, it's, you know, it's free use or whatever. I'd maybe like to commission something on Fiverr from someone, but right now I'm trying to save some cash up for some stuff coming up later this year. But I'll figure it out. We'll get there eventually. So I do appreciate you all for joining me, and I hope you have a good rest of your day/week from whenever you're listening to this, and I will see you all next time. Peace.